Party. Sanders is now channeling independents and has been since 2016 and in his state, and in Congress and so on, channeling independents into the Democratic Party. In fact, there's some polling data I heard from Nevada, or I don't know if polling data is the right term, but there's data from the Nevada Democratic Party primary that they have, that the Sanders campaign and the Democrats in general have brought a lot of independents into voting in the Democratic Party primary, which is a step backward. If you're an independent, and not all independents are for progressive, but hopefully you're an independent, many are, to take a progressive independent turn, you're for a new party and it's not there yet. You know, of course, that's not all the independents, but that is some of them definitely are out there ready for that. Polling data shows that a lot of people are ready for a new political party. The whole Sanders thing that's happening right now, whether he gets the nomination or not, is a step backward in the sense of independent politics. Now there's going to be a lot of, oh, we'll just do what Sanders did and we'll run as a Democrat, you know. And here's what they'll say the strengths are. The strengths are the corporate media won't ignore us. Well, their Sanders supporters would say the corporate media has ignored him a lot, and I would kind of agree with some of that. But he has gotten a certain spotlight under the corporate media. But you have to understand that came after he kind of proved himself within the Democratic. He was kind of vetted by the corporate media by being in the Democratic Party. And ironically, the corporate media started out calling him a Democratic Socialist as a pejorative. But in reality, he's not. He's not a Democratic Socialist. He hasn't been. He's redefined Democratic Socialism to mean the kind of policies that the FDR regime, the Johnson regime, JFK regime put forward. In other words, liberalism. In other words, Keynesianism. He redefined those policies as meaning Democratic Socialism. They don't at all. Though, you know, Roosevelt talked openly about saving capitalism. Johnson, no one ever considered him anti-capitalist in any way, despite the Great Society reforms that he was feeling the heat of. There's movements in the United States that were beginning in his term against the war, but also against poverty. Even in the post-war upswing, there were pockets of huge poverty in the United States. And huge pockets of poverty in the United States. And then, of course, JFK, you got Bay of Pigs. You got, if you look closely at JFK, you have making peace with the apartheid, Jim Crow Democrats. You've got cutting corporate taxes for the first time in decades. Decades, 63, 52. First time in decades, really cutting corporate taxes. A quick look at the truth of the FDR administration, the truth of the Johnson administration, the truth of the JFK, Johnson escalated Vietnam War and all that. This is not socialism or anything. It's not any hinted internationalism, no socialism, no democratic socialism. It's just a way of Sanders redefining democratic socialism into liberalism, because that's really what he believes in at this point. I think it's genuine on his part that he really sees himself as a liberal. Other people would label that social democracy or democratic, social democratic in the European sense, but it's not. And a lot of socialists are making this fundamental error because they're not using a Marxist methodology of looking at things scientifically, looking at things from a material basis, because there has never been a social democratic party in the United States of any mass character. There was a socialist party, which probably would have become that sort of formation if it had grown. It probably kind of was that ideologically, if you think about it, if you look at its programs and so on. But it was independent of the Democratic Party completely and the Republicans. But unfortunately, it did get, basically disappeared. It got weakened to be virtually unknown and then split. And what's left of it are very tiny. You got the DSA's roots go back to the Socialist Party, but there would be the right wing of the Socialist Party. And they're just a paper organization, although that they can, there's energy, some energy there within DSA. And then the Socialist Party, which no one's ever heard of, it's a very small organization. These are the ideological roots, rooted ideologically in the Socialist Party. Organizationally, they're not anything near where the Socialist Party got. But it's arguable that the Socialist Party really reached truly mass status. That's arguable. I think it kind of did, but it wasn't enough to before the Palmer raids and all the boom in the 20s and so on. It wasn't enough to survive that, and it was usurped by the Communist Party in terms of organizing strength and ideology and so on. A lot of Socialist Party activists went over to the Communist Party when that got going, in the U.S. in the late 20s, early 30s, mid 20s into the early 30s, and beyond that. We've never had in recent memory, certainly, or perhaps never. If you exclude the Social Party, which I still excluded from Social Democratic Party status because it never reached a certain level, although it was a mass party, and it's a fine distinction. We can argue that, but let's leave that aside. Since the Socialist Party of the 20s and before that, 1920s before that, you haven't had any sort of party to the left of the Democratic Party that reached any even near mass status. So it's just the Democrats, Republicans, the duopoly, despite local, regional attempts to go beyond that, including in the 30s and 40s and so on. They never took off. And you've had that duopoly, as it's called, not a monopoly, but a duopoly of the two corporate political parties owned, paid for, owned by big business. Up until this time, Sanders decides to run in 2016 and now in the party of big business, the Democrats, one of the parties of big business, the Democrats. Fundamental mistake, not the first one to make it. Historically, not the first left populist or progressive populist to be in the Democratic Party. But a lot of people ignore that history, I think to their peril, and in terms of understanding what's going on and in terms of what's really going to happen is going to surprise the crap out of them, but in a negative way. Is there any other way? Surprising the crap? Yeah, okay. Anyway, this is so Sanders has taken this trajectory of that others before him have to try to reform the Democratic Party at best. If he really thinks that can happen. Now, jumping ahead to the kind of argument that someone really, really wants to still pretend to be a socialist but support Sanders would say, wait a minute, Sanders is raising these issues, these progressive issues. Absolutely, yeah. And that's a positive thing. There are some there. But he's chosen the wrong vehicle in which to fight for them. Oh, if he'd gone off on his own and fought. Well, I didn't say go off on his own. He could join with independents. He could join with left greens. He could join with people that are ready, and there's millions of them around the country that are ready, that have already broke with the Democratic Party. They're not going to vote Democrat. They're not going to vote for Sanders even with a progressive program. And would he be in isolation? Because Sanders was infamously said, I don't want to be like Nader. Now, Nader's weakness was Nader never wanted to do the party building. He never wanted to build a political party. He wanted others to do that somehow miraculously, or he didn't think that was that important. That was Nader's fundamental flaw. There were other flaws, but that was his fundamental flaw. He didn't want to build a workers' party of any sort, a labor party, a third party to the left of the Democrats, different things you can call it. Sanders gave up on that a long time ago, too, up in Vermont. He started off interested in that project and abandoned it. But was there a scenario in 2015 where Sanders could have said, hey, I've been in the Senate a long time, supporting the Democrats. I'm not going to support them anymore. I'm going to run as an independent. I'm going to go out there and find anyone else that will support me as an independent through these other places, independents, the California Peace and Freedom Party, the Shama Sawant effort in Seattle, and then later in Minneapolis from the Socialist Alternative, from other groups. Can I go around and gather together the forces to start building a workers' party? And the answer is yes. The answer, would the corporate media have attacked you and tried to isolate you? Yes, even more so than now when you have the Democratic Party label. Of course they would have. But that's what you do if you're a socialist, right? If you're a Marxist, you don't put your personal vanity ego project over the needs of the movement as a whole. And I'm not saying Sanders is doing that now, but there could be an element of that in what he's doing. And instead, you're trying to build a mass movement, again, not through the Democratic Party, a corporate political party that swallows up mass movements, that destroys mass movements, that weakens mass movements. And instead, you do it through the hard slog of organizing. And if you build enough, the corporate media will be forced to acknowledge you. Remember Occupy? Corporate media ignored Occupy for 3 weeks. I was there. I was part of that. Then they came back and started to cover it because it couldn't be ignored anymore. It was taking over, occupying public spaces in cities all over the country. Imagine if you start a workers' party or a labor party and you do workplace occupations, say in 5 or 10 different cities. Say you do an Occupy-like thing where you just occupy public space and to amplify your voice. Say that you win some elections, but you say, I'm not just running here in Seattle, I'm running as part of this effort across the United States, as part of an effort for a workers' party. That will help build a workers' party. Now, would it have built one before Sanders reached a certain age or whatever? Unknown. It depends. Again, conditions change, you know, for better and for worse. You never have perfect conditions. So let's use the McGovern example again. McGovern had that mass movement of the anti-war movement and movements that spun out of that, the reinvigorated women's movement, the environmental movement, and so on. The unions were stronger then. You had this new left, which a lot of it ignored the Democratic Party and electoral politics, but some of it was open to independent politics. And McGovern used some of it for his Democratic Party initiative. Wins the primary and then gets sabotaged. People turn against him in the Democratic Party itself and so on. And this is something that... And McGovern's program was a little bit to the left of Sanders, but he was certainly also had that time in the South Dakota as a senator, and he didn't break with the Democratic Party, which was his McGovern's mistake. But, you know, so even if you stay with the Democratic Party, all the things you think you're accomplishing, media attention rather than isolation, reforming the party rather than starting a new party, these are actually negatives. You're not going to reform the Democratic Party. It's been tried many times. It's not going to happen. You're not going to get enough publicity that you want. The kind that you want as a Democrat, and you might suffer a period of isolation from the corporate media, but that can be a strength. That can be a way to organize on the ground to the point where you explode as an organization and they can't ignore you anymore. And then there's people that would say, well, wait a minute. One thing you haven't talked about is, okay, Sanders won't start a mass movement because he's a Democrat. They don't do that. They focus everything on, you know, getting themselves elected, re-elected, getting the next person that they endorse elected, re-elected, building the AOC Sanders caucus in the Democratic Party. Oh boy, that's going to go nowhere. That's going to actually help the Democratic Party. Already has. You know, the Pelosi can exhort them on one hand. On the other hand, she's probably quite happy they're bringing in youth and voters and so on into the realm of the Democratic Party, which is horrible, actually. But what if inadvertently, what if Sanders didn't support mass movements, or let's be more precise. He didn't initiate mass movements as commander-in-chief if he won the nomination and won the election against Trumpo. Looks like it's going to be Trumpo, right? So what would he do? Again, in power, I think there would be enormous pressure for bipartisanship, enormous pressure for Democratic Party unity, and Sanders would try for those things really hard. And even if he's blocked, he would be really loath to move towards any kind of real movement building. It just doesn't fit the profile of President of the United States, which is almost like a royal position of royalty, the way it's been redefined over the years. And but say that inadvertently, say Sanders just said a few positive words. Yeah, we still really need Medicare for all, and I'm really blocked. And say that people on the streets took that as their cue. Let's move. Let's fight. Let's go get Medicare for all. That would be really great. And we would be a part of that. I'd be part of that. Independent Socialist Group and myself and others would definitely be a part of that. But see how many like pieces of the puzzle have to fit together to get to that point. And there's no guarantee, obviously, that Sanders is going to get the nomination, right? Despite the polling that's happening right now, there's no guarantee that once nominated, he'll win the election. Despite that, I think he would be more popular than Trump, but there's just no guarantee over that. There's too many variables. And who knows what would happen to Sanders' message and some of the things he's putting forward that are progressive closer he gets to an election. It's, I think it'd be turned into more, as it already sort of is, more anti-Trump and so on, more centrist in some ways. And then Sanders gets elected, and again, so these two unlikely scenarios have become likely and happened, and he got the nomination, he won the election, he's in power, boom, Democratic Party still going after him, and the Republicans are going after him, and the position itself is he's I represent all the American people, bipartisanship, party unity, the Democrats, all that, but he lets out some sort of, you know, positive peep, gets a bill rolling for Medicare for All, but it's kind of stuck or whatever. It's being watered down. Would that put forward? Would that make a mass movement more likely? Possibly would. There have been times historically where the progressive in power on a state level, even a national level like Roosevelt, so-called progressive like Roosevelt, they would put forward things that then activists would kind of distort. Roosevelt's pro-union. Actually, Roosevelt was very anti-union, and more troops were called out on unions under Roosevelt's time than any other in the United States. But they would say, oh, yeah, the National Labor Relations Act, you know, from the early 30s, that shows that unions are, that the government likes unions or Roosevelt likes unions and all that. And they would use that rhetorically and propagandistically. I mean, is that enough? No. There was a lot more going on in the 30s that gave weight to that movement. The upsurge of the CIO starting in 1934, the growth of the Communist Party and other left parties at that time, I think it had a lot more to do with that than activists here or there distorting what Roosevelt said, you know? So Sanders is still seen as some sort of progressive champion in power as president, and yet there's no Social Democratic Party underneath him. Because I started to explain earlier, there is no Social Democratic Party in the United States. Never has been, unless you want to count the Socialist Party, maybe, from the 20s, or teens and 20s of the 20th century. That's long gone. So you have the Democratic Party. Has it ever been Social Democrat? Never has been. It's not a Social Democratic Party. And that matters. Because even a Social Democratic Party moving to the right, like they all have eventually, they actually had a time where they were more progressive. They had a time even when they started, where they were even revolutionary. The Democratic Party's never had that. There's going to be a deep reserve of conservatism within the Democratic Party, or liberalism, really, which is a conservative, and small c, conservative political philosophy, pro-capitalist and so on. That's going to be there. It's already, you can see it there, obviously. And it's going to try to undermine anything Sanders tries to do. He's not going to be in a party like even real social democrats that have a Social Democratic Party underneath them, even one that's in turmoil, that are in ferment, there's still a wing of that party, a big wing of that party usually, that you can rely on. Or there are examples of revolutionary parties, Social Democratic or even more to the left parties, that they do get isolated politically based on, you know, anything from military coups or pressure from U.S. imperialism or whatever historically. So there'll be other pressures, you know, not necessarily of that nature, but other pressures on a Sanders presidency if it came to that. But then without a party or significant party base to fall back on in Sanders' case. And that is something that at least socialists, at least people that try to take a scientific approach to politics, should understand as a fundamental flaw and a fundamental weakness in trying to use the vehicle of the Democratic Party to reach power. Because every step of the way, every step forward, it's two or three steps backwards. It's dragging you down. And that's the scenarios every step of the way, whether it's going for nomination, getting a nomination, or getting power as a president. The Democratic Party is there basically, fundamentally, and in its majority to try and stop that, really. I mean, there's going to be machinations against Sanders. Obviously, they've already started to stop him from running, even though he's, from a certain extent, useful to the Democratic Party and has proved himself as loyal to the Democratic Party. There are wings of the Democratic Party that don't agree with that. And they want to stop him from being nominee, obviously, and they'll do fuzzy math, and all sorts of other stuff to try to stop that, the whole delegate thing. I mean, look at the structure of the Democratic Party with the delegates instead of the popular vote, just like with the presidency, the Electoral College versus the popular vote. There are checks in the system. Now, I don't think Sanders is that much of a threat to the system. He's not really a democratic socialist, so those checks might not be applied. Those checks might be, hey, you know, we're gonna risk Sanders. The big capitalists say we'll risk Sanders in power because we have ways to isolate him once he's the nominee, or once he's in power, and we'll be able to still come out on top of that. But he might cost us some money, so it'd be better if he didn't do that. You know what I mean? It's not like they're all a monolith in the ruling class. It's not like they have crystal balls to tell what the future is, you know, that some sort of magic to tell exactly what the future is going to be. But it's also not like there's different ideologies represented in the overarching ideology of pro-capitalism. There's different ways they think you can achieve that. So you could see some capitalists that would say, well, there is a crisis really in the society of inequality. There is the looming environmental crisis, or that's already here. Say you're a really smart capitalist, you're saying this. So therefore, someone like Sanders is the perfect vehicle for riding out the storm for capitalists. He'll be like a Roosevelt. He'll save capitalism by putting a progressive face on it, you know? And why are we so confident in that? Because he's got no political party behind him. The Democratic Party is pro-capitalist. It's a capitalist party. Sanders as president, would he be able to hollow out that party, even as president? No. Nope. It's not going to happen. So that would be... But then that astute, let's say, capitalist could say, well, wait a minute, though. What could be the collateral damage of a Sanders candidacy? Could be people get their hopes up. They get their... Their expectations are increased. This is a positive thing coming from the Sanders campaign, but it could come from a lot of other sources as well outside the Democratic Party, including trying to form a workers' party, of raising people's expectations around issues like healthcare and public education in general. And they don't like that. And big business, mostly for the most part, prefer lowered expectations and so-called realism and so on. And a lot of what Sanders puts forward can fall into that, especially if you look at it internationally. Under capitalism, there are universal health care in other countries. Now, one thing they don't tell you about countries like Britain with a national health service or Sweden or whatever, one thing they don't tell you is that those things under capitalism are constantly under attack. They're not like enshrined in the constitutions of those countries. Well, forget about that. Doesn't matter if they are or aren't. They're not like impervious to being weakened at any given moment under capitalism. And they are. They are. That's why you can see in a country, like if Sanders in the past, and sometimes he still does talk about Scandinavia as his model of democratic socialism. Those are capitalist countries. A lot of problems in those countries. Living standards actually falling in those countries in a lot of ways from what they were at the height of the post-war upswing, post-World War II upswing. But you have, and you have the rise of far-right parties in a lot of those countries. How could that be if everyone had a decent life and so on? Well, you can't have, you know, capitalism is a global system. Socialism has to be an international system, a better one, you know, and it has to take into account that no country is isolated. Therefore, you know, if these Scandinavian countries want to compete on the world market, then they have to those companies are going to exploit. Even the governments could try to run things like the U.S. government does when it nationalizes something like Amtrak, something, try to run it as a business. And that sort of, those attacks by capitalism never end, you know. They're always trying to claw back any social benefits that are won. Now, it would be a good thing to win, even under capitalism, a lot of different social benefits, like, Medicare for all, like free education at public schools. Those would be things that everyone should support. But under capitalism, they're just, unfortunately, momentary gains. They're a step forward at best. They're not socialist. Because under socialism, that would be it would be guaranteed. There would be no private sector competition that would always be trying to undermine what the people had achieved in social benefits. Another problem, obviously, with Sanders, if you want to get into that, and it's very, very important, people want to ignore it ideologically, he's not a socialist at all. But I'll give another sort of positive aspect of Sanders is the way he has chosen to, when he's described as a democratic socialist, he has chosen to take, and this is actually a negative thing ultimately, but instead of saying, oh, no, I'm pro-capitalist like Warren, he says, well, this is what I mean by democratic socialism. Now, then what he means is really liberal capitalism. It's really reformist. It's really achievable under capitalism with a big movement. But again, he's not going to be the one initiating those movements. He's not going to be able to take a step further and say, okay, yeah, even if we achieve national health care, meaning Medicare for all under his terminology, how do we keep that funded and how do we fully fund it when the capitalists are there every moment of the day, every minute of the day, trying to undermine that? with their significant political power. It's not like they're just equal citizens. They are people with enormous billions. Look what the effect Bloomberg can have on the Democratic primary with his billions, is jumping in, buying up airwaves. All of a sudden, he's polling. You know, who? I mean, polling probably pretty low at this point, but maybe not. You never know. That's just a rough analogy to what they do every day behind the scenes or whatever with their money. And so that contingency, that future, that reality is not prepared for by someone like Sanders, who is essentially a progressive populist, essentially operating in an isolated manner as well. That's why the thing of the party, whether you're going to characterize falsely Sanders as a social democrat or as part of democratic socialism, you've ignored or social democracy, you've ignored the party aspect of that. And you just can't. It just institutionally, materially can't be ignored. Democratic Party is not a social democratic party at all. And that can't be ignored if that's the vehicle that you've chosen to run for political office as some sort of socialist, which you can't be. It just doesn't work out that way. Ideologically or practically. But there is a scenario. You can't rule it out. All these other things, all these other scenarios don't work out as they're likely to, where a Sanders presidency raises expectations. He hasn't given up the ghost on the on some of these issues. And people are like, hey, wait a minute, this guy Sanders, he got elected to do this, this, and this. It's not happening. What are the chances of a mass movement coming out? There could be a mass movement, right? Now, that's too much of a gamble for a serious socialist remarks, for all these puzzle pieces to fall into play so that at some point, maybe raised expectations equal a movement outside the control of Sanders and the Democratic Party in the future sometime. That is not the most likely scenario. It's possible, and if it happened, socialists and myself and independent social group, I think, would be, you know, definitely a part of that right from the go-get. But that's not the most likely scenario, nor do you bet everything on that. You build on the ground the hard slog of building not just mass movements around issues, but a workers' party that could be a vehicle for movements in between elections and during elections and bring people together outside the corporate political parties, outside the Republican and Democratic parties. And that's where Sanders took a wrong turn, obviously, way back in the 80s. It wasn't on a national stage, so people didn't care or notice it. Now it's happening and people are just ignoring it. Okay, well, he's a Democrat, doesn't matter. He's in the Democratic Party, doesn't matter. That's all that matters, really. That's really what matters. So you don't have the political organization to put through things that you stand for in terms of a mass movement and working. I think in the United States, you need to have both. Obviously, everywhere you need to have both. A movement around issues, but those issues also, movements also backed up or part of the movement for a workers' party and part of a workers' party of some sort. That's how it's worked in other countries. You know, like in Canada has national health insurance, not because a national health service, not because people in issue groups, that's not just because people in issue groups liked it and wanted to have that going back to in the 50s and 60s. They did. But it didn't become a reality until they formed with other groups the New Democratic Party, a workers' party in Canada in 1964. And then all of a sudden that, I think it was 64, then all of a sudden that took on reality, organizational reality at a much higher level. And to get ahead of the game, the liberals and conservatives eventually caved on that issue through that pressure of the New Democratic Party, right? And I wouldn't want to call the workers' party here the New Democratic Party because it's too much Democratic Party and, you know, you'd get some real careerists and real corrupt people involved. But, you know, you could have a party that's clearly independent of big business and the corporations in terms of funding, clearly resting on the unions and on working people for money, and putting forward national health care in a way that's much stronger than what Sanders is doing now, much stronger than what the Democratic Party could or come up with at all. And much stronger than what Sanders plus the Democratic Party, Sanders being a face, a populist face of the Democratic Party, can come up with or do. So we can't, and there's another angle to this too, of sometimes movements unfortunately get defined as individual leaders. And that happens with some of the best socialist movements, some of the broadest Marxist movement, like the Russian Revolution before the Stalinists took it over. You had certain leaders who were identified clearly with the Bolshevik Party, Lenin, Trotsky, others. In Germany, around that time, Rosa Luxemburg, Karl Liebknecht, others. That's the way the capitalists tend to analyze things, is through sort of individual, the great man theory of history, quote unquote, all that kind of garbage. And it unfortunately is hard for even socialists to break out of that kind of analysis. And but that's something about the Sanders phenomenon that bothers me, is that by not trying to organize a political party, he is signaling or just acting as, hey, this is about me, you know? And if you want these good things that I'm putting forward for the most part, Medicare for all, so you better support me in the Democratic Party as a Democrat. So it's siphoning everything into him as an individual and into the Democratic Party. And, you know, it's a contradiction, but the Democratic Party functions on these individual candidates. It's this, electoral machine run by the DNC, which is a corporation. It's not a political party in the sense of memberships and so on. And so that's another aspect of this that kind of bothers me, that it's so reliant on Sanders. And obviously, I've already gone to the Democratic Party enough to so rely on the Democratic Party that there's no way socialists should support this. It's just not a way forward, despite some positive aspects in terms of program and so on. And a lot of people are voting for Sanders or supporting Sanders from a good place. Don't get me wrong. Their heart is in the right place. They don't see an alternative out there. They don't see how it could be built quickly. It could be built very quickly. I mean, every time I mention anything about Sanders, you could add the phrase, unless he breaks with the Democratic Party. If he broke with the Democratic Party, warts and all, individualism and all, he would be a trigger, a lightning rod, I think, for building a workers' party. Hopefully it would be centered around him completely. But even if it seemed to be, it would still, I think, open up space for a more genuine mass movement for a workers' party. And, you know, all those years in the Democratic Party, I feel would be lost years, unfortunately. Not necessary to organizing a workers' party. Like, he could have paid attention to the Labor Party in the 90s, got involved with that, for example. But a lot of people, until they see and can break, until an organization can break through the wall of the corporate media, that people don't see an mass alternative electorally, they're going to do the duopoly thing, most of them, or a lot of them. A lot of people won't, myself included. A lot of people will register as independents and vote independent and vote, find a way to vote independent, even in presidential elections, vote left independent for me, if someone runs like Howie Hawkins or somebody. But that's, even that is supposed to be part of, it should be part of building a mass movement, a mass political party outside of the Democrats and the Republicans. And you don't do that by channeling all that political energy from a decent program, or some programmatical points that are decent, like Sanders has, and channeling that back into the Democratic Party. And that's not a tangential thing. That's not an incidental thing. That is a crucial thing, you know. So, you know, to Sanders supporters, if you want to really become a socialist, right, then you have to look at these other things, the party, need for a workers' party, the party that exists, that Sanders is working in the Democratic Party. Doesn't mean that every programmatical point Sanders putting forward is bad. They're not. They're quite good, a lot of them. But how are we really going to win them? And that's going to include both building a workers' party, but also building an organization of committed Marxists and socialists that are going to be able to, organize beyond a workers' party and organize for fundamental transformation of from capitalism to socialism. So, by the way, if you want more information about socialism, that goes beyond, you know, trying to reform the Democratic Party and all that kind of stuff that doesn't work, then you should get in touch with independentsocialistgroup@gmail.com, independentsocialistgroup, all one word, @gmail.com, if you like some of the ideas you hear on the radio show today, because, we and others are fighting for things on the ground, even during the election time, that's really taking up a lot of, it's, people are forced to, you know, look at, I won't say forced totally, because again, millions and millions of us don't do it, but a lot of people are forced to, seemingly forced to vote for the their class enemies to vote for the rich people of the Democratic Party, or the rich people of the Republican Party, vote for the corporate political parties, one or the other. But a lot of people see through that even now, even when there's progressivism being put forward in certain demands through the Democratic Party, through mainly the Sanders campaign, but also even Warren campaign to a certain extent. There's still a lot of things going on. Recent data from the Labor Bureau of Statistics, I think it's called, from government agency, shows that strike activity has continued to increase past 2018 into 2019. We'll have those figures in detail in another show. Towards union organizing, we don't have data yet that density, meaning percentage of working people in unions, is increasing significantly. Excuse me, but it is it has more of a chance to with increased strike activity. Again, a lot of probably union activity, not probably, I'll say this without qualification because I've been on the executive board of a union and I've been in three unions and helped organize other unions, that during election time, as long as union leaders and unions leaderships have their heads, well, let's put it a nicer way, as long as they are have illusions, severe delusions and illusions in the Democratic Party, and that would include with Sanders in the Democratic Party. Again, if he leaves the Democratic Party, they should support him. But as long as he's in the Democratic Party, the illusions of the Democratic Party have been disastrous for the labor movement. Lesser evilism has been disastrous for the labor movement. Lesser evilism means voting, usually means voting Democrat over Republican, and not trying anything else, not trying to form a new party. And so obviously Republicans are a party of the corporations. Doesn't take much in a lot of areas to see that Democrats are as well, which is why you have millions of people not voting for either of them, while you have many more running as independent. But there are certain election cycles, every election cycle, where lesser evilism is brought in as an argument that Democrats use to get people sucked back into voting Democrat and thinking about the Democrats and forgetting all the other stuff that has to happen politically. Even within the Democratic Party, there's a whole lesser evil thing that happens between so-called establishment Democrats and progressive Democrats. And in reality, the lines there often blur as well. Meanwhile, at the grassroots level, there are things that need to happen in the labor movement and beyond that some of us are involved with, an independent socialist group and also elsewhere. And you might notice, and if you read the Globe at all, the Boston Globe, if you're in this area, if you're from out in Worcester, but also it happens, pops up in other areas, there's more agitation, let's say, more information getting out there around the need for free public transit, free bus services, that sort of thing. And in Worcester, Massachusetts, the second biggest city in New England, a city about 45 minutes to the west of Boston, there is a movement that I'm personally involved in, and other members of the Independent Socialist Group are involved in getting getting free bus service. But our position is also expand the bus lines in general, because they've shrunk due to previous fare increases. And people not being able to pay, ridership falling, dead end axing the routes. So expand the bus service, free bus service, and also introduce light rail, start building light rail in Worcester. And also, as community control and oversight over this expansion of public transit, of free public transit. And this, of course, would be a great thing for the environment, be a great thing for working people, just being able to get to work and so on. It's important to Worcester because Worcester is cheaper than Boston in terms of living standards, and it's you actually have people, believe it or not, commuting in a big way from Worcester to around Boston or in Boston and back to Worcester again every single day just to have the cheaper rents as of now in Worcester. Now, Worcester is also having this Paw Sox minor league baseball team from the Red Sox get built, unfortunately with public money. So it's not a good thing. But if they've coughed up the money for that, they can cough up the money, which is much, much less, only a few million, for free bus service, and then a few millions more to get, they're handing out over $100 million to the Paw Sox, they're calling it. They could get that for public transportation. And we see this as part of the fight for socialism, although it's a reform that you can achieve under capitalism. It's also a reform that hopefully will increase people's, raise their expectations. If this can be free, what other things can be free? What other things must be free for the environment, for our own livelihoods, for our own lives, for our own future, and so on. So there is a rally, there's a city hall thing in Worcester where this Zero Fare Coalition is trying to turn out people to a public hearing, and so are members of Independent Socialist Group trying to turn out people to a public hearing of the Public Service and Transportation Committee in Worcester, which has which is meeting Monday, February 24th, this Monday, 5:30 p.m., Worcester City Hall, third floor. And, you should go and you should bring a sign and be ready to speak for a zero fare, no fare, free bus system in Worcester. But again, also, if you want to, put forward the demand of expanding the bus routes dramatically and having and starting to build light rail and having all that under city control, under municipal control, with strong oversight and partially governed by a new organization that would democratically be elected and subject to recall and so on, that would be just for public transit, instead of having that all in the hands of the Democratic Party. And by the way, if you were listening to earlier in the show, all this analysis of what the Democratic Party is like, this comes from bitter experience, okay, on the ground and over time with the Democratic Party. And in fact, you have an example of that. Worcester Telegram and Gazette, I think it's still in print paper there, but definitely online as well, saying, oh, well, wait a minute, fare-free WTR bus is not happening this year. And then you read that, it's wrong. There could happen tomorrow. But they're just saying, there isn't total agreement among the Democrats, because that's all there is over in Worcester, about funding it, even though it's only a few million dollars, that it just can't happen this year. Well, it can happen. There's also, by the way, meetings happening in different cities around Eversource and I believe National Grid, two power companies of maybe two or three that are in New England, about electric rates and gas rates and stuff like that. And that stuff's really, really expensive. It's one of those hidden inflation things we were talking about earlier in the show. They say inflation is low, but for certain things, that's really quite high. So if you can find where Eversource or National Grid public hearings are happening, you should really think about going to those. And there's one, there's some happening around Boston and Worcester areas. I don't have all the details on that. I thought I did. I apologize. I don't have everything I need to have on that. Speaking of that, falls into the category maybe of public service announcements. Let me go to our public service announcement book here and read an official one or two, because that's our duty here on WMFO. And I wonder if that hands-free phone one has gotten in here yet. Anyway, we're going to just quickly do this one I've done before, but I like it. It's talking about something that happened in the neighborhood here. Pedestrian safety public service announcement. On February 8th of last year, Allison Donovan was killed as she walked through the crosswalk in front of the West Somerville Neighborhood School on Powder House Boulevard, two blocks away from Tufts University. After fatally hitting Allison and injuring her companion, the driver sped away, stopping later at a restaurant for drinks and dinner, and also to Home Depot to buy materials to hide the damage to his truck's body. Walking is one of the safest forms of transportation, but pedestrians need to pay attention to their surroundings, especially when crossing streets. Even if you have the walk light or other clear right of way, bad drivers are everywhere. Don't expect them to stop what they do or to stop for you. It's critical to comprehend some people really don't care that much about your life and would drive away if they hit you. A potentially life-saving message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Community Radio. I would just add to that I've been teaching my kids, and I still have a young daughter and a, I guess, adolescent son entering adolescence or in adolescence. I really went overboard, I think. Maybe not overboard, but I really stressed the pedestrian walking safety thing to the point of every time you cross a driveway, stop, not stop necessarily, but just look really carefully. Is anything backing out of that driveway? Anytime you're in a parking lot, just be hyper vigilant looking at cars backing up and stuff. It's very complicated stuff. And here in Massachusetts, starting today, they're implementing a law of hands-free phone. You know, you can't use your cell phone, to put it simply, unless it's a quick thing for GPS on your dashboard, or unless it's unless you're stopped off the road, basically. You can't even be double parked and use it. That's going to be interesting, since I've seen a lot of people texting when they're driving. It's been horrible. But I have to say, though, that's just tip of the iceberg in terms of how insane Massachusetts drivers are. They're just crazy. There's a new phenomena happening. It's been happening for about a year now, where people have stopped figuring out how much space they need to pull into a line of traffic, or even just to pull in front of one person driving towards them. They're now taking real risks of pulling out into in front of you, in front of, let's say, me or someone else, with very little room to spare. So you have to really put your brakes on not to hit them. And if it's a line of traffic, they'll just pull into, if you're not really tailgating someone, they'll force their way in. And I think the objective sort of material reason for that is that there's more traffic on streets in Massachusetts than there used to be, more cars and stuff. Again, hey, make the public transit free and we'll loosen that up. So that's where it comes from, but it's still wrong. Like, there's many times where someone will pull out in front of me in a very risky maneuver with very little time to stop, for me to stop or slow down. And I look behind me to see, why'd they do that? And this would be on a big straightaway, even, where you can see really far both ways, and there's no one behind me. No one behind me, but the mass hole has gone out and decided to swerve in front of me for no reason. Wow, what do you do? Well, if they're in Massachusetts, what they'll probably do, the person that just almost caused an accident, will probably not use their directional, their turn signal, when they get to the next turn. Whether there's even oncoming traffic on the left-hand side of the road coming, you know, towards you. I've seen many Massachusetts, quote-unquote, drivers not signal they're taking a left-hand turn. They'll just pull in front of the person who then sees them pulling in front of them and has to slam on the brakes to avoid an accident or get an accident. I've seen accidents happen because people didn't use their directionals. And I was talking to someone who is a native of Massachusetts. I've been here a long, long time, and I'm still not a native and proud of it in some ways. A native of Massachusetts who said his mother, for example, also a native, she would never, ever use her turn signals, just as a point of pride, just wouldn't do it. That kind of thinking is just insane. And that's what I would like to see a law. I'd like to see that law enforced, really. And instead, we have the craziness out there. Now we've got the craziness of or try to end the craziness of people texting and talking on their phones. Good idea, but again, tip of the iceberg. And the fines are way too severe, actually. Some people are going to get, I think, wrongly, they might touch their phones or something, and some cop will see them, and then all of a sudden you're going to be paying a $100 fine after a grace period of about a week from now, a week starting today or something like that. That's too prohibitive. That's kind of out of control. Just like parking tickets are out of control now. They're like $30-$35 now in some places. Hey, public transit versus walking, public service announcement. If you take public transportation, good for you. You're helping to save the environment and money too. Now, this is kind of a liberal thing, slant on this. You're not saving your own money, because public transport, if these people even ride it that wrote this, is a lot of money, way too much. You know, I'd have to pay $2 and something to go one subway stop now, you know? I mean, it's just ridiculous. Anyway, but if you aren't getting all the exercise you should be, you might want to consider walking directly to your destination instead of using public transit. Again, where I live, for example, no public sidewalks. A lot of places in the United States, you can't walk safely. So this is the whole, like, thing on things that are really social in nature and need to be addressed that way. But anyway, depending on the distance, once you factor in the time it takes you to make your way to the T-stop, wait, and get that final destination from the station, walking the whole trip can often be faster. Unfortunately, that's true in some places, yeah. But as far as it goes, why not have a more efficient transport system? Anyway, and even when it isn't faster, you're getting good exercise and saving more money. You're probably breathing in a lot of exhaust fumes as well, which isn't maybe might obviate the good exercise. But anyway, for example, if it takes 45 minutes to walk where you want to go instead of 30 minutes using the T, you'll get 3/4 of an hour of exercise and fresh air just for that extra 15 minutes of your time. And that's a real healthy deal. That's a public service announcement from WMFO and Medford Tufts Educational Radio. So anyway, Minority Report on that PSA, public service announcement, not really. Just doesn't take into account the reality of why people rush to places to begin with and the problems with public transportation. So we promised we'd get to this article, The Great Affordability Crisis in America. We'll do that in the next 5 minutes real quick, and then we'll have to sign off. It's from Atlantic. I got it online. I think it's probably in their print edition, February 7th, 2020. And it talks about gives some stats on the economic boom, so-called. For example, quote, the economy hit its highest point since 2000, right before the dot-com bubble burst. There's a lot of, the relatively low unemployment and so on. Again, I'm trying to skip over here. So there's some statistics that can show you a roaring economy. But for millions, we still have, one of the best decades of the American economy has ever recorded. Families were bled dry by landlords, hospital administrators, university bursars, I don't know how to say that word, and child care centers. For millions, a roaring economy felt precarious or downright terrible. Viewing the economy through a cost of living paradigm helps explain why roughly 2 in 5 American adults would struggle to come up with $400 in an emergency so many years after the Great Recession ended. That'd be around 2008 or whatever. It helps explain why 1 in 5 adults is unable to pay the current month's bills in full. I'd say it's more than 1 in 5, but whatever. It demonstrates why a surprise furnace repair bill, parking ticket, court fee, or medical expense remains ruinous for so many American families despite all the wealth this country has generated. Fully 1 in 3 households, there we go, is classified as, quote, financially fragile. And there's a link to that. So she adds to this, along with the rising cost of inequality. Oh, I'm sorry, the author's name is Annie Lowry. Again, February 7, 2020, Atlantic. Along with the rise of inequality, the slowdown in productivity growth, and the shrinking of the middle class, the spiraling cost of living has become a central facet of American economic life. And not quoting, earlier in the show, I gave some examples of that. She uses some of the examples here as well. And it explains a lot about not only the popularity of, say, Sanders, but also Trump. You know, right-wing populism, left-wing populism, they're not at all the same. Trump does horrible damage. But what I'm trying to say is that people, and she mentions this too, Trump included, if they hear some sort of thing from Trump, I'm going to save manufacturing, even though it's a lie, their people are desperate to hear that. And some people are going to go for it. Actually, the statistics on working people voting for Trump are not as bad as you're led to believe by some liberals. It's mostly the upper middle class people and rich people that voted for Trump, but there are some workers obviously voted for Trump as well, but not as many as you're led to believe sometimes. That's not what this article is about, by the way. Price of housing. Here she goes. Price of housing represents the most acute part of this crisis. In metro areas such as Bay Area, Seattle, and Boston, which we're emanating from Greater Boston here, this show, severe supply shortages have led to soaring prices. Millions of low and middle income families are no longer able to purchase centrally located homes. The median asking price for a family home in San Francisco has reached $1.6 million. Median asking price for a single family home in San Francisco has reached $1.6 million. Even with today's low interest rates, that would require a monthly mortgage payment of roughly $6,000, assuming that a family puts down the standard 20%. In Manhattan, listings for sale, this would be condos, now ask for an average of nearly $1,800 per square foot. The housing cost crisis in the Bay Area in New York might be the country's most obscene, but the problem is national, and this is an important point. Driven by a combination of stagnant wages, restrictive building codes, and underinvestment in construction, among other trends, home prices are rising faster than wages in roughly 80% of American metro regions. In 2018, housing affordability declined in every one of the 160-some urban areas analyzed by the National Association of Realtors, save for Decatur, Illinois. I guess we all have to move there. Rising prices and housing shortages are squeezing families from Reno to Minneapolis to Phoenix. And now the problem extends to rural areas where income growth has lagged in the post-recession period. So a recent report by the Pew Charitable Trust found quote, sizable increases in the number of households spending half or more of their income on housing in rural countries across the rural counties across the country. And the housing crisis is hitting places like Bertie County, North Carolina, Orion County, Texas, etc. Just to finish off this article, and again, I'm reading this because it gets into, if you want to figure out in a shorthand way, some of the reasons why people are voting the way they are now, why some demands, good demands, being put forward, although in the wrong format, the Democratic Party, some good demands are an unachievable format. Some of the demands are resonating. The cost of living crisis extends beyond housing, where healthcare costs are exorbitant. Americans pay roughly twice as much for insurance and medical services as do citizens of other wealthy countries. Twice as much as do citizens in other wealthy countries. This is the wealthiest country in the world in terms of aggregate wealth. And they don't have better outcomes from all that extra money being spent. So anyway, this is definitely worth checking out. Goes into daycare. Families now commonly spend $15,000, $26,000 a year. I personally experienced a lot of this stuff and talked about it on the show. And we'll get into it more next time. And we're going to start winding up here so we get the next person in and ready to go next show if someone's coming in. You were listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. I'm sorry, Socialist Radio. We changed our name a little bit. Socialist Radio, and that's talk and music from a socialist perspective. We're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. If you want more information, you can write to us at independentsocialistgroup@gmail.com. You can go to, our Facebook page is messed up. Facebook messed up my access to my own Facebook page. So there you go. Anyway, thanks for listening. And take a critical attitude towards all the kind of propaganda you're hearing in the electoral realm right now. Fight for the issues directly, not through the maze with no end of the duopoly of the two political parties. We need to create our own alternative as working people politically, and that is happening here and there, believe it or not. And also, as we said, check out in your area, or if you're in Worcester on Monday, go to the city council public hearing on free bus service. It's not called that, but that's what it is, basically. And also check out the places around the state where Eversource or National Grid are having, they're forced to have some public hearings about, meetings about, they want to raise electoral rates on all of us, and they're already way too high. One thing we didn't get to this week is international events, some things that are happening. We'll get to that next time. And again, thanks for listening.
Sometimes, but we're gonna find it and we're gonna survive this. Snapping for a supper in the middle of winter, you're across of a storm in a calm blue sea. But you're my girl, you're kin to me. Kin to me. Too far. winter. Calm blue. Searching for souls in the middle of winter. You're a cries of a storm and a calm blue.